officially welcome everyone to today's Internet Seminar. My name is Jean Balance. I work here at the EPA's Technology Innovation and Field Services Division, where I'll be here to serve as your online moderator. Our seminar today has been sponsored by the University of California Davis Superfund Research Program. We'll be joined by Dr. Jane Hightower from the California Pacific Medical Center based in San Francisco, California, as she delivers a talk on capturing mercury, the human body experience. Before we begin the technical portion of the broadcast today, I'm going to cover some basic housekeeping and instruction items so that everybody's comfortable with our session. Our entire event will be offered online through an interactive forum called Adobe Connect. All participants will actually be able to listen and watch in real time as Dr. Hightower provides her presentation. She's actually going to move through the materials. You guys should be able to see a live webcam image of her, and we'll be able to interact with her online. We have made the presentation materials available in advance, and if you have chosen simply to download those and dial in on the telephone line, please note there might be some elements, again, of that interactive portion of the session that you'll miss out on. So I'd encourage you to try to join us online through the full broadcast to get the full impact of the delivery. By default, online audio is available to every person who has signed up, and if you're having any problems with that online audio, you're going to try to control that or check that locally first. You may need to boost your speaker volume. You may need to go into your sound control and increase your speaker output. Sometimes wearing a pair of headphones can help. If anybody has any problems with that online audio, we do have toll-free telephone lines we'd be happy to share. You can use the Q&A window in the lower right corner of your screen to report those difficulties with the online audio or request the call-in number, and I'll be happy to distribute it. For those of you that have chosen to join us by telephone, we have globally muted all of the telephone lines, and we would ask that you remain on the global mute to help cut down on background noises or disruptions. If we have a chance to allow for open questions via the telephone lines, I'll remind you how to take yourselves off of mute, but until then, again, please remain on mute. That Q&A window will remain open in the lower right corner of your screen during the entire delivery. I'd encourage you to feel free to take a moment to look at it now. I'll show you where it is and how it works. You can type up comments or questions at any time. We'll privately hold them in a queue, and when we take a break for Q&A, I'll read them out loud on your behalf to our presenter so that she can address those questions. Again, any technical issues, you need anything at all, feel free to use that Q&A window to let us know. Our entire session is also being recorded, and you will automatically receive a notification via email as soon as this archive is available. If you like what you see here today and you're interested in learning more about what we do, you can browse the nearly 500 free online technical sessions that we've archived on the CLUIN website. So just a quick reminder, again, I'm going to pull up a little pointer to show everybody. You're going to see the slides navigate in real time here. If you need to, you can increase the size of the slides by pressing the full screen button. If you want to turn that view off, simply press the button again. You'll see a live video here. And our presenter can take questions and comments by submitting them in the Q&A window in the lower right portion of your screen. Simply type them here and press enter or click the little cartoon bubble, and that will privately submit them to us. That's the end of the technical reminders that I have for the session today. So I'm going to go ahead and turn things over to you, Dr. Jane Hightower, from the California Pacific Medical Center based in San Francisco, California.
Thank you. This is actually Candace Spear, and I am part of the Superfund research program here at UC Davis, and it is our pleasure and honor to have Dr. Hightower visit with us today. As you've heard, she's currently an internal medicine physician in private practice in San Francisco with special interests in health, environment, and the food. She also did her medical training at the University of Illinois at Chicago and a residency here in San Francisco at the St. Mary's Medical Center. And now, without further ado, Dr. Hightower.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. This is one of the first high-tech video internet deals I've done. We're just going to get started because I have a lot of material to cover. First of all, when I started with this issue, being allopathic medicine, internal medicine trained, really we were not looking at contaminants like we should, and we still don't look at contaminants as a source of problems for people. And it was just by serendipity that one of our colleagues, Kathy Fields, who put together the proactive acne medication and treats a lot of people with hair loss, had seen a lot of people with hair loss in her office, couldn't find out why. She heard about on public radio that hair loss could be associated with eating mercury in a lake in Idaho. So she tested it on someone. That person's hair level was very, or the blood level was very high. We repeated it. It was still high. It was in the teens, but we didn't know how to interpret the results. our laboratory said normal is less than 13 micrograms per liter at the end of a work week. Well, I didn't know of any occupation that required you to eat mercury, so I wasn't sure why that was. I was usually using inorganic mercury occupational exposures. And still today, that has not been corrected, and many labs are giving you inorganic levels. Cecil's textbook of medicine, normal was supposed to be less than 50. EPA then said less than 5. The NRC said less than 5. The Finnish Men's Cardiac Study, they're indicating you should have less than 8. And the FDA, I could not get any kind of level. Is it 200? Was it 400? How could you be this far off? So why is methylmercury such a menace to human health? Well, it can't be cooked out of the fish. Even, you know, my sister calls me Tomaine Jane. I can't cook it out myself, probably. But methylmercury is also, on average, 95% absorbed when consumed. It's taken up by all tissues 1 to 2 days after a single dose. It penetrates every cell of the body, where it can disrupt cell division, molecular pathways. And the half-life in the majority of individuals, the average person, is about 2 months. But number 6 on the slide is the most important, and we're going to get into this. And it binds what's called a thiol group, and we'll define that in just a little bit. That's not doing it.
You right-clicked.
Oh, let's go. So the fishing industry, when I got started in this, this did not make me very popular with the fisheries, and I apologize, but my job is to take care of the patient. And to sort these things out. The fishing industry said there's never been a case of mercury poisoning from normal consumption of ocean-going fish in this country. Well, define poisoning. Then let's define normal. And we allowed the industry to define both of those. So what's normal for one community might not be normal for another community. And also, what constitutes poisoning? Well, it's a Middle English term, 13th century. It's a substance that through its chemical action usually kills, injures, or impairs an organism, something destructive or harmful, a substance that inhibits the activity of another substance or the course of a reaction or process. Well, the truth is there's never been a blinded placebo-controlled study giving humans methylmercury to discern the entire spectrum of adverse effects ever published. And I doubt your institutional review board would really allow you to do this, but at the same token, it's so toxic to study, yet we can tell you that, oh, go ahead and eat it? That doesn't make sense to me as a physician. So what is the human body's defenses? Well, I try to put it in terms that my techies can understand. The human body consists of a hard drive. That's your DNA coding system. It's software. It has a lot of software programs, cell-to-cell signaling systems, NF-kappa-B, notch signaling. These are proteins that sit on the cell and tells other proteins and cells what to do. It has special software for firewall protection, for intrusion prevention, antivirus. There's also glutathione, metallothionine. And if you see my DNA is in the wrong place, if you get the DNA in the wrong place, you get the wrong message. It's supposed to be bacterial defense. And so all those have to be in place for the body to work smoothly. So what is nuclear factor kappa B? And it is said that most diseases are because of a missignaling of nuclear factor kappa B. It is a thiol protein complex that controls the transcription of DNA. It's found in nearly all animal cell types. It's involved in cellular responses to stimuli such as stress, cytokines, free radicals, ultraviolet radiation, oxidized LDL, bacterial or viral antigens, anything that gets into the cell. It tries to take that to the DNA and says, what do we do with this? So it's a first responder, and it affects the gene expression. So you get the physiologic response of an inflammatory or immune response, cell survival response, cellular proliferation. And if you get incorrect signaling or a chronically active NF-kappa B system, it could lead to cancer, inflammation, autoimmune disease, infection, improper immune development. So this is really being studied right now, what this all means for the human body, how does it interact with the DNA. What is glutathione? Well, this is the body's master antioxidant. It is the most abundant intracellular thiol peptide. It contains one amino acid residue each of glutamic acid, cysteine, and glycine. It plays an important role in biological oxidation reduction processes and as a coenzyme. It helps other proteins, in other words, in some ways. It also is a key to breakdown, inactivation, protection against numerous toxicants, to include methylmercury. So what glutathione does is it complexes with toxicants, viruses, bacteria, and it takes it, it just escorts it out the body in the urine and feces mainly. But the human body has to make it. Metallothionein, we're still trying to figure out what metallothionein does. We haven't figured it out. We know it's a family of thioproteins that has the capacity to bind both physiological, such as zinc, copper, and selenium, and xenobiotics, such as mercury, cadmium, silver, and arsenic, heavy metals. It may provide protection against metal toxicity. In humans, large quantities are produced primarily in the liver and the kidney. Wow, methylmercury, what does it do? Well, it bonds strongly to thiol compounds. Okay, what is a thiol? Well, a thiol is a class of organic chemical compounds, similar to the alcohols and phenols, but containing sulfur atom in place of an oxygen, or otherwise known as a sulfhydryl bond. You hear a lot of people talking about sulfur bonds, thiol, and and also the next term being mercaptans. And this is the most interesting thing I find, being that I took a lot of biology and chemistry in school. Thiol compounds form strong complexes with many metal ions and many cofactors. In fact, the most important factors that help us in our body are all thiols. And the term mercaptan was derived in 1835 from the Latin mercurium captans, or capturing mercury, because it forms the strongest bond with methylmercury. That's why it's so important that we don't get exposed to methylmercury. And it makes it the second most toxic substance to humans known, next to plutonium. So important thiols, well, there's the three I talked about, nuclear factor, kappa B, glutathione, and metallothionein. So what do we know about NF-kappa-B and mercury? Well, mercury prevents the NF-kappa-B DNA binding by the mercaptide bond formation. It interferes with NF-kappa-B's ability to read the DNA and receive proper signaling. This inhibition of the NF-kappa-B DNA binding it modulates your cytokine expression. Now, remember, the cytokines, whether it's the interleukins, any of the inflammatory cytokines is what we're just studying in disease and can be quite variable between individuals of what really gets produced during certain toxicities and causing disease. It also enhances the sensitivity of kidney cells to the apoptotic stimuli, which kidney cells are usually resistant, which is interesting. When you look at kidneys, it's very sensitive to inorganic mercury. And in metallothionein 3, or, you know, that's metallothionein is also in the kidney. So we're trying to figure out how does that all play out in inorganic mercury. So glutathione in mercury, it binds most strongly to mercury. It's the number one to get out of your body. Glutathione is going to grab that first and get it away from your DNA and try to get rid of it. And it is escorted from the body and the feces and urine as glutathione conjugates. So glutathione, its job is to keep toxicants from causing cellular damage and stimulating your NF-kappa-B. Well, I have to talk about selenium if you're going to talk about glutathione. Ocean fish selenium content is fairly uniform amongst species, but methylmercury can vary over 100 times, even between the same species of fish. But selenium is an integral part of glutathione. So a lot of those proteins, those coenzymes, all the little proteins that modify our genetic expression, the way we run our bodies, are selenium compounds also with sulfhydryl bonds. And so glutathione really needs selenium in the body. But here's the catch. Selenium is very tightly regulated in the human body. So the effects of inorganic selenium, because a lot of the fishing industry have researchers and the coal-fired power plant people are saying, oh, well, it has selenium, that's going to protect you. Well, not exactly. We do know that selenium is involved with glutathione, and you have to have it to make glutathione. But in this, I left you with this paper to read from 2010. And what they found was if you had too much inorganic selenium on board, yeah, it might protect the brain, probably with the complex of glutathione, but too much selenium is also toxic to the brain. And it forms mercury selenium salts, which we don't even know what that means yet. So we don't want to take a lot of selenium, and because that's what I'm seeing. The message was getting across that, oh, we just take selenium and we can eat all the mercury fish we want. And then I started seeing people with selenosis. And people were coming with belly aches, and their selenium was really high because they were thinking they were going to counter the effects. Acute oral exposure of selenium results in pulmonary edema, lesions of the lung, cardiovascular effects, tachycardia, gastrointestinal effects such as nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, abdominal pain. You also can have effects on the liver, headaches, irritability, and chills. And there's also chronic effects of selenium. So where are all the selenium? You could take supplements, but some people were trying to save the rainforest, as it says on the package, and eat Brazil nuts every day. And as you can see, Brazil nuts are about 600 micrograms per 30-gram serving, which is about 8 Brazil nuts. So you can see the tolerable upper intake level is 400 micrograms per day can lead to selenosis. So can you get selenosis from eating too many Brazil nuts every day? Yes, you can. So don't do that. I've seen it. Please don't try to get an antidote. Let your body do what it's supposed to do and eat some nuts and seeds. They are important in the diet, but don't overdo it. The bottom line, I'd say don't waste your limited supply of selenium and glutathione detox system on unnecessary toxicants such as methylmercury, because methylmercury depletes glutathione. Moving on, it's really important that you know that too much mercury can lead to NF-kappa B stimulation, which might not be a good idea. So the longevity game. Well, you want a quiescent but appropriately responsive NF-kappa B. It's supposed to be laying in wait in your cells. You want to have plenty of glutathione should something come in that needs to be escorted out the door. And you need an appropriate DNA for the environment you live in. So some polymorphisms and changes in the way you may handle certain toxicants might serve you well in one environment, but not another. So living organisms must balance the oxidant-antioxidant status. And the body is always in a pro-inflammatory and anti-inflammatory state, and it's constantly oscillating in the human body. We need both sides of that so we can have repair mechanisms. And the repair mechanisms need to stop when it's supposed to so you don't lead to cancer. You want to send out an antibody, but you don't want too much in the stimulation of antibodies that might cause autoimmune disease. But humans aren't created equal. And there are what's called polymorphisms. And there's polymorphisms and changes in how the expressions of these alleles and the DNA responds. And that means whether it's glutathione, NF-kappa B, metallothionein, or vitamin D. So polymorphisms are essentially a multiple or variable alleles of a gene within a population, usually expressing different phenotypes, and allows for the human population to survive as a whole in many environments. Some allow protection, and some may lead to susceptibility, but it does determine the expression of toxicity or disease. So let's look at what they found in glutathione polymorphisms. Now, this is all new papers, and there's even more in the last year or two, because why is it that some people can walk through a chemical field and swim in a chemical soup and make it out okay, seemingly, and the next person can barely inhale the dust and don't do well? Well, there's one of the things, it's a glutathione S-transferase, that is involved with complexing toxicants with glutathione. And if you can't complex very well, then you can't remove the toxicants very well. And these polymorphisms, they call it the minuses there, the null, these are the null polymorphisms compared to the positives, that was looked at. And what they found is that in this paper, the hair mercury concentrations were higher in those who couldn't complex correctly with their glutathione. Another paper to leave you with, an environmental health perspective, they looked at this again in Korean mothers. Now, what's really interesting is these moms only had blood mercury level of 5.53, and the cord blood was only 3.5. And the moms were pretty equal on their blood levels. But they found with the null heterozygous up here, the elevated mercury levels in the mom during late pregnancy were associated with an increased risk of lower birth weight. For mothers with both of the null genotypes, both maternal and cord blood levels were associated with lower birth weight. And they had a hard time knowing how that interaction was. I'd like to see on that whether the babies were typed also to see if they were also receiving the gene, so that's really important. But the intact genotype had no inverse relationship of mercury level and birth weight. And as you know, that low birth weight gives you an indication of problems with the baby and can indicate other damage. So genetic influences on the retention of inorganic mercury. There's another Goldminer paper, and what they looked at, the actual glutathione production. So now you have the production of glutathione as opposed to the conjugation effect. And they found that those who had this certain allele, they had lower glutathione levels and higher mercury levels. It's pretty straightforward. And I know that this is possibly being looked at some of the large epidemiologic studies because that might vary over a population. And it's really fouling up the epidemiology when you look at it because there's such variation. So, again, another paper with the same thing. You know, as the older you get, a lot of people don't make as much glutathione. And the question is it our ability to not make it or it's getting chewed up? It's kind of like a snowball going downhill for an elderly person. You're picking up sticks and garbage and more snow along the way, and you just can't, you know, get rid of it because we do see that there's a lot of elevated toxicants as people get older. And the same token, there's higher risk of cancer as you grow older. So immune modulation, same kind of thing. You get also stimulation of autoantibodies. It's probably through NF-kappa B stimulation, genetically susceptible. We know that mercury was grandfathered in to the for thimerosal for vaccines originally as an antiseptic, but it's a very poor antiseptic for encapsulated organisms. And so, but it's remained in the vaccines because it's a strong adjuvant. And adjuvants stimulate more antibodies so that you can use less antigen in the bottle. And it, I don't know if this is a cost saving or what the issue is, but we do know that there's autoimmune issues with mercury as well. So what do we see in clinical practice of what I've seen that there's worrisome areas in medicine for an internist? Well, methylmercury, yes, there are nonspecific symptoms. And if you read my book, you'll see that I went on a hunt for where those people were and how they really a lid was put on those who were saying, oh, I've got a headache, you know, I've got a stomach ache. Because a lot of the methylmercury criteria for poisoning only looked at overt symptoms for the purpose of compensating for their losses of income and poor health. But you have to get a lot of other symptoms before you're going to get brain damage and some of these more visible effects. Cardiovascular disease, we know that omega-3 fatty acids and can help with downstream cytokine prevention or blockage. But you still, if you have too much mercury, it's just not, omega-3s are not strong enough to counter the methylmercury if it gets too high, and it's at a very low level that will happen. Other things, neuropsychiatric effects, mad as a hatter, Infertility, there's been papers, especially in men, for infertility with methylmercury. There's, of course, fetal effects. Then the saccades, you know, your eyes moving. People have to have their eyes move at a certain frame when they move their head and when they move their body. And if they don't move properly, then they're susceptible to falling. Now, the Canadians have looked at the Inuit and populations at long-term methylmercury exposure. They had abnormal saccades, not quite like Parkinson's, but it's Parkinsonian-like. And for neuro-ophthalmologists, this is a very important factor that had not been looked at because falls and hip fractures are a big risk for death in the elderly. But I think the most important is increased susceptibility to other disease. If you're binding up your glutathione, missignaling your NF-kappa-B, then what's going to happen if you have all these other chemicals? And Environmental Working Group, I know, is working toward their testing of, they had one paper they put out with 10 American infants, and they found up to 358 chemicals found in the babies and the cord blood. 232 of them were targets of regulatory action and government controls. One newborn, 191 chemicals. And same with adults, a lot of chemicals. And that's a problem because if you have a polymorphism, you can't get rid of the mercury as well. So who are sensitive individuals? They always talk about sensitive individuals. Who do I consider in my practice of internal medicine, diagnostic medicine? I love the big puzzles. That's what I see in my practice. Well, number one, developing brains. Those with polymorphisms in any of the detox or protective pathways. And we don't normally test those. I know you can go to some of these boutique places and have some of these things tested. They will test your glutathione system. Some of my patients have had it done, but you know, I don't know how accurate the tests are. If you have concurrent toxicants, that might not be good either because it's amplified. How about your chemotherapy patients? Do you really want your chemotherapy patients, while they're getting poisoned from the chemotherapy, to have methylmercury? No, you want those chemotherapy agents to do what they're supposed to do, and hopefully they won't get cancer in the first place. Autoimmune patients, that's obvious because it's an adjuvant. You don't want them to get stimulated on their autoantibodies any higher than they already are. Those genetically susceptible to cancer and autoimmune disease, they might not want to raise their methylmercury level. Coronary artery disease, of course, gastrointestinal disease. And what about chronic infections? Tuberculosis, the mycobacteria infections, HIV and Lyme. These chronic infections, the question is, if they don't have chemicals in their body, will they get rid of these infections better? And one of the things that's being looked at now with drug-resistant tuberculosis is to raise glutathione level, actually, to get rid of the tuberculosis. And of course, then another one I thought of was our transplant patients. You know, CPMC, where I work, is a transplant center, and they're on a lot of medications. They're immunocompromised. The last thing they need is to have mercury coming into their body. So what is a poison? Well, Paracelsus in 1493 to 1541, when he was alive, he said all things are poison and nothing is without poison. Only the dose permits something not to be poisonous. So I ask you, do adverse effects determined at the cellular level but not previously identified by epidemiology still constitute a poison? Where do we draw the line on when the dose doesn't make the poison? So instead of epidemiology, we're going to have to go back to the lab and use the precautionary principle. And I have to say something about omega-3 fatty acids because this is still being studied. And omega-3 fatty acids is sort of a downstream anti-inflammatory. And we're still trying to discover how powerful of a downstream anti-inflammatory they are because it's one of those where if you take too much, more isn't better necessarily. It will just, you just have a lot of expensive stool when you go to the bathroom because you're taking too much because the body does get saturated with omega-3 fatty acids. So the treatment, well, avoidance is first. Antioxidants that keep NF-kappa-B in check. There are many that are studied. Number one most studied is curcumin, the turmeric root. And there's probably, if you type into PubMed, turmeric or curcumin in PubMed, you'll get over 6,500 scientific papers on it. It's one of the most strong NF-kappa B stabilizers. It's being thrown at every disease imaginable, including mercury toxicity they've looked at. It's the only one I saw that had a paper that could possibly help. So, and I presented this before to the SUNY folks with the Gelfand Foundation a few years back, that maybe the Seychelles people had a lot of curried tuna and all those curry recipes, plus great polymorphisms that helped them and didn't hinder them. Other antioxidants, CoQ10, lycopene, quercetin, are still being studied. You have to be very careful because some of these things, like vitamin E and other vitamins that people take, if they go overboard, then they cause problems in cancer. So everything should be in a tight, tightly controlled amount in your body. As far as the alpha-lipoic acid, I think there are a lot of people looking at this one as a chelating agent. I don't know all the elements that it chelates, so I tell people if you're going to do that, I wouldn't do it more for more than 6 months, because I don't know what else it's chelating, if it's chelating out some important nutrients, until we have further evidence that it helps. But you also want to boost glutathione. I know in part, research, they're giving IV glutathione to see what happens. People don't tolerate it always very well. The alternative care doctors are giving glutathione IV, also intranasal and inhaled. But again, will you downregulate those receptors and your ability to actually make glutathione on your own if you do that? Some people come in taking N-acetylcysteine. It's over the counter now. N-acetylcysteine is used for Tylenol poisoning, but it does boost glutathione. But again, if you use that chronically, it might downregulate your ability. So the best way to boost glutathione is to not have contaminants as much as possible, to reduce it, to have a healthy diet with fresh vegetables, fruits, also eating cysteine-rich foods such as watermelon, some of your broccolis, pork has it also, but also whey protein. But you have to get the right whey protein. Doesn't have a lot of the preservatives. It's whey protein concentrate, but that has been shown to boost glutathione. And then the other one is gut bacteria. Really, we don't know who's running the show. And when it looks like autoimmune disease, there's a lot of research going into what gut bacteria can help us in preventing disease. And we haven't been taking care of our gut bacteria very well. There's a lot of things we do that totally destroy it, from medications to chloramine in the water, artificial sweeteners, certain ones have been implicated, and that's being argued now. And so we have to be careful of our gut bacteria. Put back into the sauerkraut and the kimchis and the kombuchas into your diet. And then also for the chelation, I've never chelated anybody, and that's where you give an agent to get rid of the mercury faster rate. I'm always a little wary of that because a lot of it will take it through the kidney in an inorganic form, and I'm not sure with some people that's a really good idea. And then lastly, please don't overdose on selenium supplements. Mercury monitoring, boy, there's no real way to tell you how much mercury is in your body. It can give you an indication. But giving a chelating agent even, it might just tell you that you respond well to the chelating agent, not necessarily that you have a lot of mercury in your body. So it'll give you an idea. But some people use whole blood. Some people will use hair. And I'd use a dietary history. And I tell people to keep their mercury in their blood less than 5. So the most noted recent mercury sources, well, we're still having problems with these. Some of the coal-burning power plants, somehow we went from the mercury study report telling us to use the best technologies to now we're using cap and trade, where one guy who owns a polluter and a non-polluter can level it out and get credit to keep the polluter going still. Cement factors, cement factories still in California, we have some cement factories that are polluting, and the list goes on. Latex paint until 1991, and people tend to just throw that in the dump when they're not supposed to. Artist paint still contains mercury. You can still buy vaccines with mercury. You can still get homeopathy with Mercurius solubilis in it. So we need to take these things and remove them. I always drag this up in my lectures because remember when they're arguing over what the action level is, that means how much mercury should be in our fish for consumption. Boy, was that argued. It does not protect our consumers that eat fish a lot and every day or higher mercury fish. But the people who won the court case was the industry, and when they studied a poisoning that occurred in Iraq. And this lead neurologist for the study for industry, this was his statement when he looked at the Iraqi children who had just been poisoned with a methylmercury seed grain. And this is word for word out of the Anderson trial in 1977. It said, children who were determined were mildly affected were children looking normal, running around, behaving normally, and only with the most minimal retardation. They were a little slower to walk. They were perhaps a little slower to talk. They had increased frequency of seizures compared to the control group. Their height was slightly shorter. Their head circumference was slightly smaller. These were all very, very minimal effects. I tell you, this just makes me very perturbed that these were the guys that won, and these are the guys that allowed for pollution to continue and for the methylmercury to be raised for the action level. So what do we talk about today? Where's my cursor here? I got it. So Sue Kwan of KPIX News decided, she came to me and says, well, you know, I want to, you know, I've had my children already. I want to see how much mercury will rise in my blood if I eat a can of albacore tuna every day. Well, she and I weren't too popular with the tuna industry on this one. And I said, well, you're doing it at your own risk. And she went from having a mercury level to, I think, 4.2 to 8.9 to 17.2 after 20 days. And because she was small, I figured she would be probably in the 50 range when she went into a steady state. I said, you know, you probably have done enough. That's enough. You don't, you know, we don't want to cause harm because we don't, you know, no one's really ever done this purposely, and it's not a good idea. So she asked the FDA about the action level. And this is word for word of what the FDA told her in an email. The action level is a non-binding guidance that the FDA issues to establish a level of a contaminant that may be regarded as adulterated or illegal. The action level serves as guidance for the FDA, but does not commit the FDA to take any action. The FDA action level was issued in 1979 based on data available at the time. So that's why you have fish in the markets way over one part per million. I just did a study with marlin jerky, and we had it as high as 28. The marlin jerky gets dehydrated, and it was very high in mercury, sold at Walmart and Target stores and ABC stores in Hawaii. And what happened is that the Health Department of Hawaii asked the industry to submit samples. Well, when they submitted samples, it was all very low in mercury. So I think that they should have tested at the point of sale. So questions, and you gave me some great questions. It's Candace, right, that you gave me the questions on, where is it here? I'll find my questions now. Are the patients getting the message? And, well, they're getting some messages, but it's very garbled. And most of their messages are obtained through Dr. Yahoo and Dr. Google, okay? And I always ask my patient, okay, what did you find on Dr. Google today, you know? And, but a lot of the nutrition, environmental contaminants, preventive medicine is not covered with the internal medicine exam. I know because I just took it last year. I recertified, and it's every 10 years, the third time I've passed this test. And I was very alarmed that there still is no nutrition and preventive and environmental. So physicians are not getting the message. So what knowledge gets transferred? It depends on what resources the patients are looking into. Most patients just want to know how to survive in this chemical soup. And some of them come in already ill from other things, and so they want to know, where's the action? Where do I avoid the toxicants? Should I want to? And this is not being picked up and looked at with physicians. It really should. I see both ends of the spectrum from people bringing bags and bags of supplements. They have no idea what the interactions are. They're spending a lot of money. And why don't they just spend money on good, clean food instead of all the supplements? And then one guy got a hold of some cesium, even, to treat his ailments. He had obsessive-compulsive disorder, and that's what I see a lot of the folks who get too much in the supplements. They are OCD. So I also see the opposite end of the spectrum where people say, look, I don't want to review my kitchen as a laboratory, or I don't want to make every meal a treatment. I don't care what I eat. Just give me the pills, doc. And I tell them if they want to do their diet, and I say, well, I have probably a pill for that, because big food continues to give big pharma something to treat. Nutritional recommendations, physicians, none. They're not really asking any questions about nutrition. A lot of our physicians themselves are in poor health, and I call on the physicians to start taking care of their own health better, trim down, exercise, take care of their mental health, and set an example. As far as the dietitians, boy, have you ever seen what's in hospital food? I mean, really, to try to make food economically feasible and palatable for a sick patient is really difficult. And so you'll see a lot of junk food in the hospitals. You might see hospitals that really try to do a good job. It's everything in between. People don't want, a lot of people that are busy, they don't want to shop for food. They don't want to prepare food. They don't want to cook food. They don't want to chew food. All they want to do is pick it up off the counter and drink it down, and they're happy and go on their way. And I have people who have lived in their apartments and houses for over 10 years that have never opened the oven door. So it's a real problem. So any more ideas? Please make sure you recycle your light bulbs and don't throw them in the garbage. And thank you very much.
Thank you.
Jean, do you want to read off the questions? We're not looking
yes,
at
it. Yes, you got it. I'll start reading through. And just a reminder for those of you that are on the line, if you haven't submitted your question or comment or are still typing it up, go ahead. Feel free to do so. The Q&A window appears in the lower right corner of your screen. If you increased or full screen the slides, you'll need to exit out of that, hit the escape key, or press the full screen button again so you can see that Q&A window in the lower right corner and submit them. But I do have a number of questions that are in the queue, and I'll start reading those questions out loud. So our first participant mentions that he thinks you're probably going to cover this, but just in case you don't, what about past exposure to mercury, such as industrial or occupational? Is there a reservoir of mercury in the body like lead in the bones? How do you reduce it? Perhaps Ca++ or EDTA, for example?
Well, yes. They've looked at people with heavy poisoning of mercury of different types on autopsy, and even methylmercury, the older you get, the more inorganic mercury you have in the brain as a percentage to methylmercury, because it gets demethylated, they think, in the brain. The organs can increase mercury and store it sometimes in the thousandfold difference, like in the heart, the kidneys, the brain, the liver, as opposed to the blood. And it depends on the person as to how long it's going to take to get that out. Now, that's why the people who do the chelations feel that they can keep on chelating and get the mercury out going through the urine until they're completely cleared out. And I think that it's really still controversial, because, you know, once you, you know, it could be that storing it in the organs might be better than, you know, redistributing it again into your bloodstream. That was the argument. So, again, some people think that chelation, if you go to someone that's knows how to do that. Some of your alternative care doctors who have a lot of experience with it. A lot of this is not FDA approved, but a lot of the allopathic doctors, such as myself, we don't really give chelation. The EDTA is not the one you need. It's the DMPS, or DMSA, is what they use.
Okay, great. Thank you. Our next question asks, does the use of fish pills for omega-3 result in issues with mercury?
Well, that's been asked, and I know in California in particular, you can look at the omega-3 bottles, and this is a distilled product, so they're able to distill out mercury, and it usually will say PCB, lead, and mercury-free on the bottles. And I know that there are a lot of independent people who have tested to see if that was true, and it is true that they can distill those out. So make sure that if you are going to use omega-3 fatty acids, that it says on the label that those have been distilled out.
Okay, great. And just I have a related question, and just to make sure this has been addressed again, in reference to taking omega-3s, what about the PCBs and the high levels in the omega-3, just to clarify?
In the omega-3 fatty acids that are in pill form or capsules, they should not have PCBs if they're properly processed. That means that they've gone through a distillation process, and that means that it's been removed from the pills. But it should say it on the bottle that that's been happening.
Okay, great. Thank you. Our next participant asks if you've seen a video by the University of Calgary in Alberta that actually shows how mercury tangles up neurons. They want to know if this is an authentic video and is this actually what happens when human neurons encounter mercury or methylmercury.
Well, there's a lot of papers on this, and they're using like amalgams and inorganic mercury and whether it causes a tauitis and neurofibrillary, if I can say that right, tangles. And yes, that has been shown. I think that was on a goat that they used or something like that. And but allegedly that was authentic, and that's all I can say.
Okay, great. Thank you. Our next question, is there any link between mercury and type 2 diabetes? I ask because the disulfide bond and insulin may bind with mercury, and when that happens, the tertiary structure of the insulin may be altered and therefore not effective in delivering glucose to cells.
Well, that's a complicated question, actually, because type 2 diabetes, again, they are glutathione deficient often, and it's organ-specific. So if you have a type 2 diabetic that has kidney disease, usually they find a lack of glutathione in the kidney itself as opposed to other organs. And so you don't want to mix mercury with any kind of disease, including diabetics. And I don't know how it interacts with and this is from Nick. Hey, Nick, how are you doing, buddy? Nick Fisher, my S-U-N-Y guys for the Gelfond folk. The thing is, with type 2 diabetes, you just don't want to expose someone to the mercury, and it's a very good question. Nick, I'd like to see the research on that from your institution and see if mercury will interfere with the bonds on insulin. That's a fascinating question.
Okay, great. Thank you very much. I'll keep going through the list here. We have another user who would like to know if you could elaborate on the politics associated with mercury.
Well, I think you're going to have to read my book on that one because I did write The Diagnosis of Mercury and Money, Politics, and Poison, and it was quite a few years in the making researching all the various mercury poisonings that occurred in Canada, which I'm going to cover later today, it's very involved because to settle what constitutes mercury toxicity alone was decided in courts. And, you know, the scientists were paid by industry a lot of times to come up with some sort of scenario. And there's a lot of documents that did not get published that should be. A lot of these poisons are still being argued in the courts. And the Canadian problem, and if you go on to pollutionwatch.org and look at Chemical Valley and read about, you know, the Sarnia blob, otherwise known as the Dow blob, where they put chemicals in those caverns years ago, it's still upwelling. So there's a lot of politics. They put they dumped mercury and other things in the caverns, but at the time it was legal to do so, and there's no repercussions. So there's a lot of politics. The book covers it.
Okay, excellent. We've had a couple of participants who've asked sort of related questions. Just how exactly do you ensure that you're purchasing good, clean food? Are you recommending that they take particular dietary steps? Do you think that we should eat fish? Should we not feed fish to children? Can you kind of clarify a little bit on what you think a good diet would include and how you can get that?
Yeah, this is always a good question because when I ask my patients, I want to talk about your diet, they say, well, I have a good diet. I say, well, please tell me what a good diet is because I'm still trying to figure it out. And a lot of people are looking toward the inflammation part of food, not just toxicants. So they're trying to get away from things that have been implicated in inflammatory, like enthesitis, fibromyalgia, that kind of thing, and disease in general. That means your gluten, your cow milk, and nightshade families, cooking those things. And there's a lot of research going into that. So we do discuss it and what the best diet per patient is, because not everybody is affected by some of these things. I try to get people to buy local. In California, it's a little easier than some states. Even the restaurants, it's easier in California because so many people want what they call clean food. And you want it more local, so you're familiar with the farms that are where it's being raised. There's no guarantee. And I always tell people, just rotate your poisons. But know where the poisons are in the first place. Know that if you barbecue your meat, it raises carcinogens. And frying foods might raise carcinogens. Know where those are. Learn about Teflon. Learn about whether you should cook in the enameled cast iron might be the safest cookware. That's the going trend right now. So there are a lot of things to study, and when I see a patient for these kinds of things, I spend over an hour just talking about diet oftentimes. But by the way, most physicians are not studying this. This is not being taught, and I think it's like becoming another subspecialty of internal medicine.
Wonderful. Thank you. Just to be sure we've had a lot of positive comments come in for a wonderful talk from our participants. And if you're on the line looking to provide feedback, we'll take you guys to a formal feedback survey before we close out. So I just wanted to be sure I commented on that before people hop off. But let's carry on. We've still got some more time for a few more questions. We have one participant who would like to know what evidence is missing to reduce mass exposure to mercury in the environment. What is the federal government doing in terms of limiting and reducing mercury emissions?
Well, just recently, we had this mercury emissions treaty and that 140 nations signed. It doesn't look like it has a lot of teeth to it, but at least it's a step because right now, worldwide, we're starting to make the same mistakes over and over again. We continue to have legal uses for mercury. That means the black market is going to get a hold of it and use it for the old mining of silver and gold mining and things that it shouldn't be used for. And so we need to get all the legitimate uses, and I say legitimate, that means the things we have approved so far, we need to phase those things out and keep mercury buried in the ground where it's supposed to be and quit digging it up and trying to find a use for it. We've been so enamored and so fascinated by mercury since the beginning of humankind, it seems like.
Okay, great.
Does that answer the question?
I think it did. We have another participant who'd like to know if you could comment or provide an opinion on how coal plants affect mercury uptake in the human population.
All right. Well, the coal-fired power plants, and it depends on the type of coal and the filters they have on the plants today. Some plants are more polluting than others. The newer ones are, do a much better job of keeping it out of the environment. I was told that lignite was amongst some of the coals that will give off more mercury than some of the other coals. So it goes out into the air, and it settles on the water bodies and your soils. And that's where, when it gets on the water bodies, and it can be local, and it can also move a few miles away. And once it gets into the water, then you know, the plankton, the small organisms take up this mercury. Then the small organisms eat the other small organisms. The fish take up the smaller fish. It goes up the food chain, and mercury in fish is not easily eliminated. It just really bioaccumulates in fish. And so they have a real tough time, and when we eat the fish, it gets into us.
Okay. We have one user who wants to know, isn't one of the most sources of mercury is amalgam? And I apologize if I'm mispronouncing it. They go on to say actually that they've read papers that report some methylmercury in saliva. So do we know if the methylmercury can be produced by different characteristics of saliva, like pH and bacteria floral and the oral cavities? And has this issue been explored much?
Yeah, it has been explored. Again, you know, it's a real interesting discussion. I do put that in the book, too, on amalgams. We went over 300 years. We've gone from making it illegal to put amalgam in a person's mouth 300 years ago to making it nearly malpractice to discuss with a patient to have it removed. So go figure. The amalgam, and some people, they claim that it does get into the bloodstream, and your sensitive individuals don't do well with it. And yes, there has been methylmercury that has been in the saliva, but I don't know, I haven't had a chance to really carefully review those papers, if the methylmercury came from the amalgams or what kind of dietary history they took with these people, and whether they were fish consumers and the methylmercury was there from other sources. But if the bacteria are there and the inorganic mercury or other mercury is there, then the theory is if you have the right pH, the right kind of mouth, then you're going to make methylmercury. That is the theory.
Okay. We've had two participants actually ask if you could elaborate further on the effects of vaccines in the body and how that's different from methylmercury. And again, just to make sure I'm getting the question right again, they just want you to speak more about mercury in vaccines.
Yeah, I think that all I could say is that the mercury in vaccines is ethyl mercury and another type of organic mercury. It continues to be argued between industry, non-industry, all those wanting to look at it, whether ethyl mercury is more or less toxic than methyl mercury. So I'm just going to leave it at that. But thimerosal, you know, Eli Lilly got the patent on thimerosal years ago. And again, it's in the book about that, that the thimerosal was placed there originally as an antiseptic. And in fact, where my office is, there was the Levi Cooper Lane Hospital, and the surgeons at the time thought the virtues of mercury was so great as an antiseptic, they put it into the plaster that went on the walls for the entire hospital. And they also used to put it on the floor and step in it with their rubber boots, and they would wash their hands in it, and I'm sure with the tremor that the surgeons were getting, okay, they decided to wear rubber gloves, and so it kind of got phased out. I think that we still need to get better ways. I mean, now they're using aluminum, and some of the metals toxicologists are questioning whether we should use aluminum also as an adjuvant, because it's not a very good antiseptic. It does not kill encapsulated organisms, but it was grandfathered in. So if the industry were to say, hey, you know, we're actually using it as an adjuvant, they'd actually have to go through research to assess safety. And the ethyl mercury and thimerosal never really underwent that kind of safety testing. So it's sort of a grandfathered in agent that I think will probably eventually be phased out. But we need, and the question is, I've talked to vaccine manufacturers. They said the vaccines should get to the point where you don't need an adjuvant.
Okay, thank you. We have just a few more questions in here, and one user would like to know if you could comment on the use of green teas and fiber as a way to facilitate removal of mercury from the body.
Well, green tea has antioxidant potential. It doesn't. I've never seen that green tea can actually remove mercury, and I'm not sure about the fiber, you know, because mercury just gets into all your cells. It's very absorbed. I know that cilantro is also used. Some people think that the use of cilantro will reduce mercury absorption, and I've seen that presented at conferences, so I would leave it to the person to ask the question. You might want to look at that one, see what the latest research and whether that's so.
Okay, I think I'll take just one other question online, and this question is just asking if you could just explain if inorganic mercury will transfer into methylmercury in the human body.
That's a good question. A lot of inorganic mercury is removed quite quickly by the kidney, and so I'm not sure, I haven't come across a paper that shows whether you get increased methylmercury if you have inorganic mercury exposure. I just haven't come across that. That's a first. First time I've ever been asked that. It's a good question, though.
I thought bacteria was responsible for doing conversion.
Yeah. And inorganic mercury isn't as absorbed as well as methylmercury. You know, even elemental mercury, you know, I go over in my book on some of the medicinal uses, like for syphilis treatment. They used to say a night with Venus meant a lifetime with mercury. So, because it was a syphilitic, but it never was proven to cure anyone. In fact, the mercury poisoning that you got sort of resembled syphilis anyway. But they used to use quicksilver for bowel obstruction. And they would think that just the weight of the mercury would push things through, like unclogging a drain, right? And, of course, people perforated their bowel and died, but it's the elemental is not reabsorbed. It's the vapor you have to worry about with the elemental. So if you break a thermometer, don't vacuum it up, and, you know, talk to your local toxic control or fire department. They'll tell you how to remove it.
Let's remember alcohol now.
Yeah.
What about the light bulbs?
Well, the light bulbs, yeah, make sure that you put those back to recycle, and if you get mercury, again, same thing as a thermometer, you know, you don't want to break those.
Okay, great. Well, I think we're going to close out the online questions. Candace, are there any questions in the room where you are?
No, I think we'll hold ours and discuss in a moment. I think we're at 2 o'clock now, is that correct?
That is correct. So I'll go ahead and ask. Dr. Hightower, do you have any closing statements you'd like to leave the group with?
Yeah, I'll really appreciate everybody's interest. You know, I feel so alone all this time. You know, I've been doing this and really have met some wonderful people in the last 12 years. And my thing is I think that we really need to interface the PhDs with the MDs and even with industry and put our heads together to try to figure out how to have the best products and best product for humans. We were just born to be lazy, and so that we can, you know, really live healthy and healthy lives and productive.
Okay, well, great.
On behalf of Superfund, we want to thank you very much, and on behalf of EPA as well. So thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you all so very much. And again, I just want to echo the audience's thanks for a wonderful presentation. I think I'm going to go ahead and move along with some final closeout statements, and we'll go ahead and conclude today's session. Again, if you were interested in participating in more deliveries like this, this is what we do on the Cleanup Information Network, and we'll be happy to go ahead and share our latest seminars, recorded archives, documents, and other resources in terms of cleaning up hazardous waste sites. You can find us at CLUIN, CLUIN.org, or find us out on Facebook, Twitter, or LinkedIn. For those of you that would like to and have a moment, I'd encourage you to take a look at the seminar homepage. You can download a copy of the presentation materials and a number of other resources there. I've included those URLs right within the Q&A window in the lower right portion of your screen. The other thing I'd ask you to take a moment is take a quick second to fill out our short feedback form. We would encourage you, and I do read in each and every one of the submissions that comes through. So I would thank you in advance for letting us know what you thought of the delivery mechanism as well as the material that was presented today. If you shared the line with multiple